Hello and welcome to the Rare Disease Podcast for Medics. I'm Lucy Mackay and I'm the CEO at Medics for Rare Diseases. We're equipping medical professionals to reduce the diagnostic odyssey and improve the patient experience for those living with rare conditions. This podcast will feature interviews with patients, clinicians, advocates, students, and researchers focusing on rare disease and clinical medicine from all walks of life. So sit back, relax, and if you like what you hear, follow us to keep up to date with our latest episodes. Thanks, everyone, and remember to dare to think rare. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Rare Disease Podcast for Medics. I'm Dr. Lucy Mackay, and today I'm joined by one of our ambassadors. I'm really excited about this because our ambassador program has absolutely blown up. Joe McPherson told me it was the thing to go for and to revamp it, and she was 100% right, and she does a really good job at looking after all of our amazing ambassadors. I think we've got about 30 now. So that's people who work in the NHS, people who live with rare conditions, people who work in the NHS who have rare conditions. And so today I have the honour of welcoming Deval Amratalal, who is one of our patient ambassadors and has a rare skin condition called autosomal recessive epidermolysis bullosa simplex. EB is a rare skin condition where blistering is caused by trauma to the skin. He graduated in 2021 with a BSc in physics with space science, which sounds like the coolest thing ever. Started an MSc in planetary science in September 2023 at UCL. With a passion for science communication, making science more accessible to the general public, Deval has joined Medics for Rare Diseases as an ambassador to raise awareness of EB, not just in the medical field, but also in the general public. He also works with the EB charity DEBRA in an effort to improve the quality of life of not just patients with EB, but also people living with other rare conditions. And in his spare time, and probably unsurprisingly, Deval reads science fiction novels and is also an avid motorsports fan. So welcome, Deval. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you for inviting me.
I love it, the intro. You're probably one of the coolest intros we've ever done.
Thank you. I guess I don't know what to say now.
I like this. I'm going to change the podcast title to Medics for Planetary Scientists, because that's what we're going to talk about. But no, yes, in seriousness, how you're clearly passionate about science, which is awesome. But how did your interest in this area start, and why did you choose to study about space?
So I think my interest in science started back when I was about 8 years old. I watched Jurassic Park, actually. And since then, I wanted to be a paleontologist. And then as I guess time grew on, I kind of went less on that and more on space. And I remember in primary school, there was space week in year five. And I was putting my hand up for every question. And then at the end of the week, there was an award. And then I stood up before the winner was announced, and it wasn't me.
Oh my gosh, but that's brilliant. Believe in yourself, Deval. This is amazing.
So confident, yet so wrong. But I got the consolation prize.
Was there originally a consolation prize, or did they just have to dig one out because of your enthusiasm?
No, there was one.
No, that's good.
Yeah. And then, I just stuck with it, and here I am.
And so what do you study in a sort of a planetary science MSc then?
So the planetary science is, I guess, a lot more specialized in planets. And this is on, I guess, how they formed, how you can discover them and their evolution as well. And it's not just, I guess, on that, but it's also on the stars as well, if you choose to do the solar physics module, which I was just revising for, and on habitability and life and stuff like that.
That's cool. Are you one of the people who got rid of Pluto?
No, I'm not.
I'm still sad.
I don't think Pluto was a planet. Sorry.
So Pluto was never a planet?
No. There are three criteria for what a planet is by the International Astronomical Union. The first one is you have to be round, which it is. The second one is you have to orbit the sun, which it does. And the third reason, which it fails at, is that it has to be the most dominant object in its orbit, which it isn't.
Because it's a moon in something else's orbit or something.
Yeah, it has like five other moons and other objects that are like it near its vicinity.
Mm-hmm. How did Pluto, like, how long was Pluto like playing with the big kids and the, before it got found out? Was it like, Pluto was definitely a planet when I was younger.
Yeah, I think it was discovered in the 50s, I'm going to say. I can't remember at the top of my head.
To and be then... fair, I didn't make you prep for this question. I don't know if it's one on your exam next week, but...
No, I don't think it is. It was in the 50s, and I think in the early 2000s, it was demoted.
Do you know what? I know we're randomly talking about Pluto, but I would just like to say, isn't Pluto a really good example of the scientific community going, hands up, we were wrong?
Absolutely.
I hadn't made this connection before, but hands up, we were wrong. Like, that science, you know, that this is a process. There's no end. There's no end to learning. And what you know now might not be true in the future.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But also, it's not about if it's a planet or not, because as we've learned from a flyby, I think it was in 2016, that it's full of amazing science that we didn't know that it had. So it's got cryovolcanoes, so volcanoes that spew out ice. It's got nitrogen ices. It has a very thin atmosphere, so it's a lot more alive than we first thought. So then we don't consider it as a dwarf planet, but we just put it in a category where we can just study other icy worlds. So it doesn't matter what you are, it's just what science we can do with it.
I hope everyone else is drawing the connections here, because my mind is sort of blowing up right now. By misdiagnosing Pluto as a planet, we lost opportunities, or not, you know, we haven't lost them, but we didn't embrace Pluto for what it was and learn about what it was and learn about, you know, find out what we can do with Pluto. Spoiler alert, I'm talking about patients with undiagnosed genetic conditions or misdiagnosed genetic condition. And that actually, if we get to a good diagnosis or believe what they're going through and actually understand their condition and their experiences for what they truly are, that's not just a benefit to patients and their families and carers, but in fact is a benefit to all society and healthcare. Wow, we should podcast more often, Deval.
Yeah, let's do it. After exams.
Let's do it. After your exams. So your exams are on what topic?
I have five exams on solar physics, exoplanet, tectonic geomorphology, and astronomical spectroscopy, and something else I can't remember. Planetary atmospheres, that's it.
Okay. And so when I was growing up, my favourite programme was Red Dwarf.
Yeah.
So everything I know about space is completely made up by the writers of Red Dwarf. What's his name? Rob Naylor. But I loved Red Dwarf. Did you watch any of that?
I haven't. It is on my list. I'll get onto it after I finish.
Okay. Just binge that as your reward. Partly because I've been looking for a guest to do a second podcast about looking back at Red Dwarf now, which I believe was a feminist piece of work. Anyway, so yeah, if you could get onto that, that would be really good.
Okay.
And then lastly on this topic, what was it about Jurassic Park? Now, look, I know there's dinosaurs. We don't need to say the word dinosaurs. But it's interesting to me because like Jurassic Park, again, you've got genetics and learning from the past in it. Is that related, or am I pushing that on you?
I think back then I didn't make the genetic connection, but I guess
it was just the dinosaurs.
It was just the dinosaurs, just a T-Rex doing its thing. And
yeah, you know, fair dues.
All of that. And I guess I still listen to dinosaur podcasts just to keep in touch with what's happening. And it's really interesting that, you know, we can now try and infer what colors the feathers were of some dinosaurs as well. They could have been iridescent. That would have been really cool. And what I'd like to study is the social behavior of sort of group dinosaurs as well, and you know how it would compare to other living species today.
I get some of my favorite quotes from Jurassic Park. I won't go into them now, but one of them I use and I think is really pertinent to technologies or things, you know, science as it is today in terms of health. And that is, just because you can, it doesn't mean you should.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So I quote Dr. Ian Malcolm is probably my most quoted scientist, even though he's fictional. But
yeah.
So on the other side of things, you were diagnosed with EB. When was that? Was that when you were young, or how did that come about?
So I was born in Lisbon in 95, and the doctors just didn't know what was going on. So I think I was born, and this is from my parents. So as I know it from my parents, I was born, and then about 6 days later, there was a blister on my left foot. And then I guess they put me in hospital. My parents didn't know what it was. The doctors didn't know what it was. I think I was in the hospital for like 3 months. And I was just, the blisters just continued to spread. And I was just crying constantly, as I've been told, from all of the pain. And yeah, and the doctors didn't know what to do, so they just let me go. And then eventually my parents brought me to India, where they were living, until 99. And during that sort of time span in India, they also tried to see a lot of doctors. They brought me to a lot of doctors. They didn't know what was happening. And my family's religious, so they did like all this ceremony and things to try and make me better. And well, obviously nothing worked. But yeah, I'm glad my parents, especially my mom, who moved heaven and hell to try and find something.
Wow. That must have been really scary for your parents. I mean, with a newborn baby and the blisters, and how painful that must be.
Yeah, it was. And in 1999, I came to the UK. And I think in 2000, I was diagnosed at Great Ormond Street Hospital.
So 5 years without a diagnosis, but you presented with blisters like after a week.
Yeah.
And can you say for the audience what your condition is in your own words?
So EBS is a genetic skin condition, and it causes blistering of the skin because of trauma and heat. So the keratin 14 gene, I think in my case, is mutated, and so the epidermis is weak, and hence if I walk a lot, or if it's a combination of high heat, or if I do something with my hands a lot, then I get blisters and I have to obviously rest. It takes a few days to heal up. And I guess I walk again, but I have to try not to get too overexcited about walking. And yeah, that's it. And I think my specific condition is extremely rare. I have been told it's only 10 confirmed cases in the world. My specific type.
Wow. We're very lucky to have you on this podcast then. And I guess your parents didn't know anyone else with it at the time, or?
No, I don't think so.
No. And so what happened, they got the diagnosis, and then what happened then? Do you know?
I think I was put on meds, stuff like amitriptyline to help me sleep at night.
Wow.
And iron stuff, and I guess just nutritional stuff as well, because I used to get blisters in my mouth, so I couldn't eat properly, and I was underweight and under height, and I think when I was about 10 years old, so I think 2005, I had a gastrostomy tube.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I just used to...
Into your tummy?
Yeah. And I had that for, I think, 2 or 3 years until the doctors thought I did good enough that I didn't need it anymore. So they just took it out. And I think I started using sort of oral milk. Like, I think it was called Frezubin. It was that. And I had about two of those a day or something, and that helped with my height and weight.
Yeah.
And yeah, now it's not there. It looks like I have a second belly button.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're at medical school, often you get to try all these like supplements to, you know, so things like, I've talked about my daughter had a cow's milk protein allergy and she didn't put on weight when she was born. Use that good old phrase, fail to thrive. And, you know, the milks you give for that taste awful. But I think the Frusabin type ones, they like put some nice like strawberry flavoring or something in there.
Yeah. There were some good flavors. I like the strawberry and the chocolate ones.
Oh, that's good. Did you have that weird thing at school where people are like, how do you get a milkshake, even though it's like a medication?
I mean, I did. I don't know. I mean, it was a lot of calories.
Yeah. So did it, like, how did you do? Like, how has it impacted your life? I mean, you're sat here doing a master's degree, chatting to me, and, you know, but what the picture you're painting sounds really difficult and painful. And I'm just saying, like, looking at you in this situation, I don't think anyone's going to look at you and imagine that background.
Yeah, there has been a lot of stuff, I guess, in the background that has been going on. So when I was diagnosed, I was put in a special needs school. It wasn't one with, I guess, severe special needs. It was more, I guess, more learning difficulties and physical conditions. And that was my first time. Actually, I started in year two. That was my first ever time going to school because my parents didn't put me in a school in India because they knew it wouldn't be suitable for me. And it was like a little town / village. So there wouldn't be no support whatsoever.
Would they be worried about you? Like, you know, is it the kind of thing of if someone doesn't look after you properly, you'd get more blisters and yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess back in those days, there was still, I guess, disciplining kids by hitting them or something with a cane.
Gosh, I'm just sorry to do this to you. I'm just projecting massively, but like the anxiety for your parents. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I was put in, first it was Grove Park School. I was there for a year. And then my parents found a school a bit closer, which was called John Chilton School. And then I had transport to take me to and from there. So that was good. And yeah, that was fun. Year three to year six, I made some great friends. The staff were very supportive. I still have some of them on Facebook as well, and we keep in touch. And I went to high school, which was pretty much in the same building, and we still had support assistance that was available to us as well. So yeah, it was good. The services that they provided was very helpful. I had a manual wheelchair, but I couldn't push it myself, so I had to have someone with me. And then they eventually gave me an electric wheelchair, which did great, good stuff for my independence. I can actually go anywhere without anyone with me. And yeah, and then I got another electric wheelchair afterwards, and I finished high school. I went to a sixth form where there was no, I guess I didn't need a support assistant then.
Right.
I was more or less independent, but they did take into account my disability and made arrangements for that, such as having an exam in a separate room and extra time as well. So that was good. And then when it came to universities, that was a lot of good support there as well. I still had a chair. So at this time, my electric wheelchair just didn't work. And no matter who came to fix it, it just never got fixed.
It's hard to believe, isn't it? It's just hard to believe that the difference must be huge between an electric wheelchair where you're basically mostly independent versus without the electric wheelchair, do you creep into not fully dependent, but mostly dependent on someone because you can't push or you can't walk that far?
Yeah, I can't walk that far, but I did have my manual chair, which I used as like what's it called? A walking frame.
Got it. So a bit like a delta frame what people have, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I could, at that time, I could walk, but then it did take some pressure off my feet because I was leaning on the chair. And so I guess that helped in a way. Then I went to university. I had a scribe which took notes for me, and he also pushed me to and from lectures and halls and between other lecture theatres. And it was all very spread out as well. And so I had one lecture theatre on one side of the campus. It would take me, I would be late 10, 15 minutes for my next lesson if it was at the other side of the campus more, because that was my weak point. And then I got into the University of Leicester, where it didn't go very well, thankfully. And the support there was very good as well. That was campus-based, so everything was thankfully all in one place. All my lectures was in one building. And my halls of residence wasn't that far. And I had a parking permit to park on campus.
Wow.
So I didn't have to walk far.
Yeah.
And by that time, I had a manual chair. So I have resilience in my hands where I can push myself now.
Yeah. Well, is that because it's thickened or?
I think so. But still, if I do it too much, then they'll be covered in blisters.
Yeah. Yeah. And that you clearly have pursued education. So it's clearly something you are dedicated to and enjoy. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It's my passion, and I love it. I love all the, I guess, the dead ends in science, the things that the general public don't see or don't experience, or all the code that doesn't work, and the long nights observations. Well, not yet, but I guess.
I totally get it. My first degree was in human genetics. A lot of fascinating things about working in this area now is that things that were sort of futuristic when I did my first degree, because I'm a bit old now, this is just stuff that is in my work now. that's quite, I think that's fun.
It is. I love every minute of it. That's apart awesome. From the revision.
So what happens post-masters?
I did apply to 3 universities, which I didn't get, unfortunately. So I will be looking at work. I used to work as a science presenter for kids' birthday parties. Ooh. And the same company, they said, if you want to come back, you can come back. So if I don't get anything immediately after the MSc, I can just work there until I find something a bit more permanent and consistent.
Yeah. I mean, if anyone's listening to this, you should be, you know, banging down Deval's door, is what I say. I can't pay you, but you could come and do our podcast with me. Do you want to go into a bit about like how you manage your condition day to day?
Yeah, I can. I guess it's a bit, because I'm in central London, and that's more of a challenge to me, because parking here is extremely difficult. So I've just put my car in one place and I haven't moved it. So I've been trying to, I get public transport pretty much every time I need to go onto campus, which is luckily just one bus.
Mm.
But there is taxis where I can get reimbursed from the Disability Student Allowance. Mm. So if I need to get a taxi, I can get that as well.
That's cool. And then what about like studies? So you've got mates, and I don't know if you've got a partner or anything, but like socializing and stuff. Is that, you know, do you find you get opportunities to do that? I don't want to assume that you don't, partly because, well, you know, partly you've got a lot of work to do. So,
unfortunately, with the MSc,
Big Bang Theory.
Yeah. Unfortunately, with the MSc, there's no sort of socialization outside of classes.
Yeah.
I spend most of my waking hours just studying. But I will meet with my longtime friends after the exams are finished, thankfully.
Yeah.
And I think they'll be glad to see me as well. I think so.
I think you should take a year off, do kids' parties, do a podcast, and you probably need like some time, right?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
So what made you've got a lot on, as we have covered. What made you decide to apply to be an ambassador for Medics for Rare Diseases?
So I first met you at the Parliament event. Yes, at Westminster with Deborah, which I guess we will talk about very shortly.
Mm.
And I think I'm at a point in life where I have a platform that I can use to get the word out on EB and rare diseases. So I am in the process of arranging a talk at the university after exams about EB, about Deborah and Mbwadi as well. And hopefully we can get as many people as we can in person. And hopefully there'll be a live Zoom. It'll be recorded, so anyone who can't make it live, we can send out a link to them as well.
You're listening to the Rare Disease Podcast for Medics, brought to you by Medics for Rare Diseases. If you like what you've heard so far, stay connected with us by clicking the follow button and stay updated on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We love to hear from our rare disease community, and we welcome you to join us as a rare disease ally. Just hit the links in the episode description. I think that also getting our message into other disciplines is really good, because, you know, then you get that interest across science and across industries and not, you know, processes within science and theories or applications of theories. You might be working in a different area, but there can always be that translational piece there, like we covered with Jurassic Park and and Pluto. So no, it's really good. And also getting into new universities and having more people interested in it. So it's absolutely fab. Plus, you're clearly a great science communicator. And using that is really great.
It is, yeah. I went to a conference. It was at Imperial. And I had an introductory slide where I introduced, I guess, myself, my projects, and the work I do for Deborah as well. So that was about 100 people or 100 PhD students that I had spread the word around. And I don't think most of them had, maybe they didn't have heard of Deborah, I don't know. So in case they didn't, they at least know about it.
Yeah. And so tell us about Deborah then, because, you know, it's always a bit confusing because Medics for Rare Diseases has a Deborah as one of our trustees. And actually, she knows one of the people who works at Deborah, the charity, really well. So we do end up in quite confusing conversations. But tell us about Deborah, the charity.
So Deborah, the charity, tries to raise awareness with people with people with epidermolysis bullosa. And there isn't just one type of EB. I have simplex, which is one of the more or the less severe versions. And then there's also junctional and dystrophic, which are more severe, where the people's hands and feet are sort of fused together like this. And that's incredibly painful. I can't imagine. I know I go through pain, but I can't imagine that.
So is it because of the damage they're fused into fists, or do they start fused into fists? Do you know?
I'm not sure. So I think it might be a bit of both. And then I guess skin is webbed over it,
yeah,
as well. Or
so they can't. People can't use their fingers, and you know, it's just so being able to use your hands is so important for staying alive, but also quality of life, independence.
Yeah. So Deborah supports the parents of kids with EB as well, like support for schools, and they even have holiday homes, I guess, like Airbnbs. And yeah, my work with Deborah so far, so I'm a member, and sometimes we have meetings to try and sort of shape what we're doing, and like such as how the website is going to look. Can people find particular type of information easily from our website? And yeah, stuff like that.
Have you ever been involved with research with them, or are you involved in research for EB at all?
I'm not.
Is it something you'd be like, you know, if something was sort of for your particular presentation, is that something that would interest you, or you're not sure or never thought about it?
Yeah, I'd be interested. Why not?
I don't have anything. Sorry to get your hopes up. But
oh, no.
They're just, I know that they're a big and they're a future thinking charity. Their meeting at Westminster was excellent. And I think they're looking into sort of genomic technology for treating people. And I think they get quite a lot of support from own government. So essentially they'll be, you know, this is an area to watch. But I know, as much as research looking to the future is really fundamentally important if we're going to provide a hope, but also better outcomes for people in the future, what do you need at the moment, like management wise? Is it bandages and creams and anything like that? Or do you not have a routine?
Myself, sometimes I use bandages if the blisters are leaking to the point where it's obviously going on my clothes, or, you know, if I'm writing and it's going on the paper, I can't have that at all. Or if I'm going out with friends, then I'll just bandage up. But if I'm mostly in my house or where I live, then I tend to leave them open. I don't know, but that's just me. But I do sort of different put creams on it as well.
Yeah, something that people were really raising aware of at this Westminster event is, you know, being able to access the number of bandages that people need, the amount of the volume of cream, being able to get these prescriptions regularly. It's like one tub isn't going to be enough, one packet isn't going to be enough. So things around access to the appropriate sort of, not medicines necessarily, but, you know, medical treatments.
Yeah. I think them needs, needs is a word, but yeah, I think yesterday I had an appointment yesterday, actually, and they said that there are some patients who couldn't or had difficulty getting the high-low tier eye drops because of
their eyes get dry.
Yeah, their eyes get dry and get corneal something. I forgot that.
Okay.
But yeah, due to, I guess, what's it called? Stock issues or something?
Yeah, stock issues. Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I will put a link to Deborah in the sort of in the show notes below, because, you know, if you go onto their website, it's if you're not used to going onto patient advocacy group websites and you go onto this website, you're going to see stuff for if your patient has an emergency. There's guidelines on there. There's emergency information for patients and carers. There's like particular resources for healthcare professionals in particular, so training events and management care pathways. And there's research on there. And if we don't come together in these places and bring patients together and bring people living with these conditions together, we're not going to be able to get enough people with that condition. Because what did you say, you know, how rare you are, Deborah, and then we need all of yous together to be able to get better sort of diagnostics and treatments and stuff. So it's great to have a charity like that sort of being a point of contact to go to.
Absolutely, yes. I think people need hope. And I think Deborah provides hope. And they also do, like, of course, raising events such as the one in Parliament. We also had, I was lucky enough to be invited to lunch with the Duchess of Edinburgh in November as well. So she's patron of the charity. She supports what we do. And there have been other sort of drug repurposing.
Yes.
As well. I think Phyllis Suville was recently approved.
Okay. Well, nice. Yeah. So yeah, we're drug repurposing is one of those areas. It's quite funny almost, actually, because you've got that gene therapy, like the absolute sort of forefront of science, and then you've got taking drugs that we already know about use in other indications, and then running the latter parts of a trial in a new indication. Isn't there sort of like different ends of the spectrum, but covering lots of bases?
Yeah, I think we have to cover all the bases that we can. Probably because I guess genetic technology is quite difficult. think how genes work. I'm not an expert in this, but it seems that nature has perfected this over 3.8 billion years of evolution, and we're still very new to this. So
yeah, exactly. Nature has been having a good go for a while.
Yeah.
And so there's some ways to go, but the research is the only way to sort of find out. But then also we must remember, just because you can, it doesn't mean you should. So we don't.
Yes, that's true.
Got to balance.
I really wish they should unlock my gene of having a tail or something.
Oh yeah, yeah, like residual tail.
Yeah.
Like if you were a dinosaur,
yeah.
Would you like to be an iridescent or feathered dinosaur?
Iridescent scales?
I think it's going to have to be scale, or not necessarily scales, but that like really tough rhino-y.
All right, yeah.
Skin. Because I don't
think
know.
I would have feathers.
Do they have tails? Or do they just
rhino,
have lizard skin?
I think rhinos is just thick skin.
Thick skin, yeah.
Yeah.
So go on. Well, how about this? You can choose your base layer, scales, thick skin, chameleon type stuff. And then on top of that, you can choose, are you iridescent? Are you feathered? What would you go for?
I would choose iridescent feathers.
Tropical.
Yes.
Yeah, I like that. So that's okay. So, if anyone's ever running any research or clinical trials into bringing back the residual tail or making us into dinosaurs, Davao's in. If it's EB stuff, you don't even look that fast, but those two things.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in. Okay, cool. And you said you're going to be running this event, which we're, really happy to support with. But do you have any, I suppose maybe it's potentially you. Got to get past those exams, but anything else on the horizon for you?
So past exams would be sometime after the 15th of May. So I guess very soon after that, the staff members in the physics department here at UCR are way more than happy to try and arrange for a raising awareness talk. And beyond that, I think it's just, let me just pass these exams first, but just try and, I guess, still engage with Deborah and MVRD as well.
But we're going to have a London ambassador meetup. So that will be really cool.
Yes. I believe that's in July, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll be there. Yeah.
Really nice to see people. And you live in London. You've lived in London now, but you've lived all over. That's pretty cool. Do you still have your parents around?
Yeah, my parents. So I lived in West London for most of my life. Mm. And then, I guess the first time I moved out was to Cardiff. And then it was to Leicester, which I enjoyed a lot more. And now I'm near central London.
And they're nearby. Do you get to see them very much? Or?
Yeah, I go a couple of times. I guess every one or two months I go home. Mm-hmm. and see them for the weekend.
Yeah. And, how do they, we've talked about them. This is always that funny thing about rare genetic conditions, I guess, is the first part of your story really comes from your parents, because you're too young to voice it or know what's happened. But, how involved are they now? Or is that it's just something they're used to?
It's just something they're used to now. And I guess they're proud of how far I've come. So they just sort of let me go and do whatever I want, really. Like, if I say to them, I've booked a holiday with my friends, because before it was, I guess, flights and stuff have been tricky, I guess, because how am I supposed to go on a plane with luggage and I've got my wheelchair?
Yeah.
So I still haven't gone abroad on my own.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been either family or friends.
Mm.
But last year I did go to the Dominican Republic, which was so fun. And it was for one of my friends, best friend's wedding. And somehow it all worked.
That's
it all worked.
It's meant to be a beautiful, beautiful country.
Yeah.
Read a few books about it and fascinating, yeah, history. I have to say also, you know, traveling by plane is quite hard on your own. I think particularly these days, you know, how planes have got smaller, you know, people push and it's just a little bit all less organized, if it makes sense, if that kind of makes sense. Everyone, I think there used to be this kind of idea that plane travel was luxury and you'd be lucky to go on a plane. And so it's like an experience, whereas now plane travel is no different to train travel kind of thing. So therefore, I think I can totally get it, but and why you'd want to travel by yourself. But I do think with plane travel, it is difficult alone. With all the, I find it quite discombobulating.
It is, yeah. I'm always scared that when my wheelchair, hopefully it does arrive at the other end, and if it does, it's not damaged.
Oh yeah, yeah, totally. And I had that when I lived abroad with my daughter, and we'd get to the other side, and our car seat won't have turned up. So now we can't take her in a car because we don't have a car seat. And, you know, for us, that was just a short period of her life. That's not forever. But to have that anxiety every single time.
Yeah, exactly. Because if my chair doesn't turn up, then what am I going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
I think there was one instance where I went to India with my family and my chair didn't turn up. But the luggage didn't with my medication and stuff. So my mum had a proper go at them.
I love your mum.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Mum. She's not here. But,
hopefully she'll listen to this. But yeah, no, exactly that kind of thing. That you really got to put trust in, don't you? I think that's true. Like trust is, you know, it is so important in terms of, in the end, we started using specific airlines because you grow that level of trust and it does cost more. There's a penalty because you've got that need. Obviously, ours is small, but we had things like Robin could only eat specific milk, for example. So, and we couldn't take tubs and tubs and tubs of this stuff in our hand luggage. So you've got that kind of, again, that dependency. But building up trust as companies or as education providers or whatever that you can deliver for someone's needs is so vital.
It is, yeah. I haven't actually thought about it that way. I guess it was one of those things that it's just at the back of my mind. I just like to use certain facilities because I'm comfortable with them. And as you just say, because I trust them. So yeah, it's good. And luckily I have friends that I can trust.
Mm.
And we've been on a holiday together. And sometimes because of my wheelchair, I do feel like there's a burden syndrome.
Right. What do you mean by that?
Because like they have to, I guess, like sometimes push my chair and I feel
you
guilty
feel
about it. And because they have to, and my chair is like sort of quite low down. So I don't want them hurting themselves if they need to push me or anything like that. And I think the first time I went on a friend's holiday was at Lisbon, which is one of the most wheelchair inaccessible places in Europe.
Yeah, it's like all hills. It's awful. Yeah, I mean, it's hills. Barely doable by if you can walk on 2 feet for a long time. It's barely.
Yeah, that was difficult in a way. And then a couple of years ago, we went to Spain, which was a lot better. We just spent most of it just lounging by the pool, drinking alcohol.
Mm.
So, but it was still incredibly hot. I think it was 38 Celsius. And that's not good for my skin.
Yeah, of course. You've got all of these things to weigh up. Yeah.
Yeah, so if I need to do something or go anyway, it's not I can, okay, yeah, let's just do it. I have to plan it out. And, you know, it's not just spontaneous in a way.
Yeah.
It has to work. Even if it's like using public transport in central London, I can't really use the tube. Mm. It's not all stations are step free. They say they're step free, but
yeah, they understand. Yeah,
and there was one instance where we were going from Slough Station to, I think it was St. Paul's Cathedral. And we went on to Slough Station and they said, you have to wait 45 minutes for us to get the ramp. And we needed to get the next train.
Oh my goodness.
45 minutes for a ramp. So this is where this burden syndrome came from. It's because they had to lift me and my chair onto the train, which I don't want anyone doing.
Yeah.
And then they had to do that on when we got off. And then they had to do it for the tube because we had to change.
Yeah.
And then I think Bond Street Station, their lifts and escalators weren't working.
Yeah.
So I had to get out my chair, go walk down the steps with my friends carrying my chair.
Yeah. There are so many problems that, like, you know, just not just that they're, that you, I can imagine you feeling that burden. You don't want to put anyone out, but also just you have the right to move around independently. That is your right to do in places that say that you can do that. I mean, it should be your right to do everywhere, but if we could start with the places that say that they are accessible or step free, just being honest, because actually if you were honest, then you could make a informed decision.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess maybe it's that sort of, oh, this phrase always comes to my mind, do you want the truth or something beautiful? Is actually the truth every time. Do you have ways of managing that in terms of, does it make you feel negative emotions, or what do you do to...
With that, I don't want to be that in that burden syndrome or be a burden to my friends, but I guess we all try and see if it's all accessible. And sometimes I think it was the last time I did say no, but because I was genuinely busy. And we all try and meet up, I guess, at Leicester because it's one of the most accessible cities, I guess, in the country.
Yeah,
and
I love Leicester.
It's where we've all met. It's our, I guess, base camp.
Yeah. And it's where King Richard III was found.
Yeah, exactly. Across two car parks, so Woody has to pay twice the parking fee.
I think he should.
Yeah.
He had the money. And potentially killed two of his nephews, so it feels about right.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I don't know if you have any feelings about whether he did kill his nephews, but that's a...
I don't know, I didn't know that.
Oh, the prince is in the tower. Okay, after your exams, watch Red Dwarf, and then watch The Hollow Crown on BBC, and we can come back and do this whole other podcast season.
All right, yeah, let's do it.
Okay, cool. Well, I won't take up any more of your time because I know you have to learn about planets and gases and things like that. So I just want to say a huge thank you for sharing and for teaching us a lot and doing everything you do. There's so much you do as an ambassador in so many different ways. So it was great to hear from you today, Davel. We have a Rare Disease Discs playlist. And we ask everyone to suggest a good song for our Rare Disease Disc playlist, not stolen from a popular show on the BBC Radio 2.
Yes, I have chosen a song. It's called Few and Far Between by Wild Front.
Why have you chosen Few and Far Between?
Because it came to mind, but I really, it's as if I pretend to know the words. And I think if I sang, then some ears and speakers might explode.
Might explode. The big bang.
Well, she's like, I can't do that.
That's fine. Did it come to mind for the very reason of your few and far between?
Yes, I guess so. and it's a meaning for rare diseases.
Yeah. We are for rare diseases. Well, we'll stick it on the playlist. It's on Spotify. I don't know how good it is as a... Do you revise to music?
Sometimes,
okay. I have to revise to something fairly wordless, like Moon Safari, like Air or something like that. I can't revise to really, like, lyric-y things. So I think there's quite upbeat songs on there. But when you're trying to get pumped before your exam, stick on the Rare Disease Discs playlist and find your one. I'm going to go and have a listen because I've never heard it before. But thank you so much to Val. Thank you so much for your time. Stay in touch. You're an awesome ambassador.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to do this.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the podcast. If you are interested in taking our free Rare Disease 101 module, full of useful tips for medical professionals, or perhaps joining one of our forums, visit the link in the episode description. To be notified of our weekly episodes, make sure you click the follow button to stay in the loop, or give us a follow on social media via the links provided. It means more than you know. Thanks everyone, and remember to dare to think rare. Medics for Rare Diseases is a charity registered in England and Wales. I'd like to take this opportunity to support our partners. The charity is supported by a number of commercial companies, including pharmaceutical companies, but is operated independently, and these companies have no editorial control over its contents. To find out more, please visit m4rd.org/sponsors.